Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Our guest this week is Ken Rosenthal, the fine senior writer for FoxSports.com. He's also a field reporter, as you know, for MLB on Fox Television and an insider on the MLB Network. We're going to talk about a lot about what Ken Rosenthal does as a baseball insider, both from his transactional reporting in print to what he does on television for both Fox and MLB Network, his relationships with agents and teams, how competitive baseball reporting is today. And we'll also get into his time as both a beat reporter and a columnist at the Baltimore Sun. So Ken Rosenthal has had an interesting career. It was a very, very interesting conversation on the coverage of baseball. Ken Rosenthal, senior writer at FoxSports.com, field reporter for MLB on Fox, and an insider for MLB Network, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Okay, and as promised, we bring in the Fox Sports MLB and MLB Network insider, Ken Rosenthal. Ken, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard.
Ken, when you were 22 years old, there was an editor at Newsday named Dick Sadler who told you to give up sports writing and go to law school. Is that correct?
Pretty much, that's correct. And what happened was, and I think you'll enjoy this story, I was an intern at Newsday after my sophomore and junior years, and there was this other intern who was 2 years older than me, and his name was Tom Verducci. And even then, Tom Verducci was lights out great. So in comparison, no one else really could compare, for lack of a better term. And it wasn't that Dick Sadler saw. It wasn't that direct comparison, but he just felt, evidently, that I wasn't going to make it in this business. And you know what? Who's to say he was wrong at the time? There's no way to know. And I clearly wasn't as talented as some. I knew that as a writer. I certainly knew I wasn't at Tom's level. And all these years later, I'm still not. But that kind of drove me to, because you don't tell a young guy, in my opinion, stop, do something else. And I've kind of kept that with me over the years, and I've been careful not to tell young people that. I've been realistic about the business, because the business is much different and it's much more difficult to get into. But that's different than telling someone, hey, you're not good enough. And what I would like to think is that the thing he couldn't see was desire. And I went to York, Pennsylvania to start, lived with my friend John Delapina, who went on to the New York Daily News, is now a big executive with the NHL. He was the one who really helped get me that job, and went from there. So I don't hold a grudge or anything like that, but it did motivate me. It did drive me.
Yeah, I read that. That's something that sort of that always that you remember that moment for a long time, and it fueled you professionally. Did I have no idea what happened to Dick Sadler? Did you two ever connect? 10 years down the road, and maybe he offered a little bit of a mea culpa?
No, we never did, and he's passed away now. I don't know how many years. One thing that's interesting, after that story came out in which I related that exchange initially, his son, Dick's son, reached out to me on Facebook and said, that never happened. I know people who were in the room who know firsthand of what was said, and it never happened. And I said, hey, all due respect.
Right.
One, there were only two people in the room. And two, why would I make that up?
Right, exactly.
And listen, Dick Sandler was a great sports editor. He found Tom Verducci, okay? He was pretty good. And not just Tom. At the time, Newsday was a great sports section. If he missed, and I'm not even going to say he missed, on one guy, he did okay.
What was Tom Verducci like at age 19 or 20 as a writer slash reporter?
Well, I didn't know him very well because he was ahead of me. And those 2 years at that time, that's a big developmental difference.
Right.
And I don't know that we ever hung out. I knew how good he was. I knew they brought him right back. He went to Cocoa Beach, Florida, I believe, and didn't spend much time there. He was back at Newsday, full-time at Newsday, at maybe 23 years old, which at that time was an amazing achievement.
Right. It's like Bryce Harper. He's like Bryce Harper, basically.
Yeah, more or less. And it happens even now that young people break in like that. And there were people back then, but he was a star. And you could tell from the writing, you could tell from the reporting, just the way he carried himself. And to this day, Tom is so professional and carries himself so well. It stands out. So we always tell the story, Tom and I. We always have a laugh about it, how we were interns at Newsday together. It's kind of amazing, really. And I take a lot of pride in having been there with him at that point.
All right, I do want to get into your time in Baltimore because it's very fascinating to me, your relationship with Ripken. You were very critical, and deservedly so, by the way, of Peter Angelos, and that must have been an interesting time for you. But in 2017, Ken, what's interesting to me is that you are at the top of your craft in terms of news breaking, whether it's transactional stories or stories with, you know, a little bit more heft. But how do you, when you are sort of looking at your day-to-day or week-to-week role, how would you define what you do?
It depends on the time of year to some degree. Now, during the season, and I was thinking about this because I figured you might ask, I wake up, whatever, 7, 8, 9 o'clock, usually early, start reading. I read papers from all over the country. I check in on all 30 teams just to make sure I'm updated on what's going on with every club because I am responsible for every club. That is the start of the day. Then, depends on the day, early in the week, I'll go to MLB Network. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm usually there at some point for some show. Friday, I am at the site of the Fox game preparing. Saturday, we do the Fox game. And Sunday is often a day I push back a little bit, but things happen on Sundays. They play every day in the sport. And we had, let's see, the Harvey stuff happened with his gallivanting. That was a Sunday. That story broke.
Right.
The Noah Syndergaard injury was a Sunday. So it really never ends. Now, the playoffs are a different animal entirely. I'm with Fox, and we broadcast every day. Well, every game. And I write pretty much every night. So that's a long, long day. And it's a grueling situation. Tom and I do the same thing. And it's what we love to do, so it's not a problem in any way. But by the end of October, we're both pretty cooked. And then my off-season, I do the MLB Network Hot Stove Show, which starts at 9 a.m., goes to 11 a.m., get there by 7 every day, Monday to Friday. And, again, I'm always reporting, always trying to get stories. Because in that situation, I have to have material every day unless I want to talk about stories that other people are writing about. So I'm pushing myself always in season two, every day, to find out stuff and get something interesting out there.
Ken, how do you what do you perceive to be the value of transactional reporting in baseball?
I don't know. It's a fair question. And there have been many, many times where I have questioned the value of it because, let's face it, if I break something or John Heyman or Buster Olney or somebody else breaks something, they basically have it alone, or I basically have it alone for, I don't know, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever the case might be. And people will say all the time, fans sometimes, we don't care who breaks it. We don't know why you guys credit each other. It's irrelevant to us. But at the same time, I look at some other things too. I got all these Twitter followers. They're hanging on this stuff. MLB Network certainly likes it when I have things. Fox as well. It's not my main function or the main part of the job, but information is a big part of it. And I do struggle with the value of it when it's so competitive, when things happen so quickly. But I don't know. It seems people like it. So I don't really know how to get off the hamster wheel, if that's what you're asking. I'm on it, and I'm stuck on it, and I'm going to be there for a while, it looks like.
How competitive is the baseball beat, and who do you look at as your competitors, or do you look at every person covering Major League Baseball as a competitor?
It is competitive. I don't know that it's more competitive than NFL, NHL, NBA. I wouldn't know that because I don't have any contact with reporters in those sports. I barely know what's going on in those sports because I'm so wrapped up in baseball. The guys that I compete with most heavily, I would say, would be the national writers. John Heyman, Buster Olney, Jeff Passan, John Morosi. We used to work together, but now he's more MLB. Those guys. But at the same time, there are plenty of men and women covering the sport on an everyday basis for their teams, or the teams that they cover, they're all really good, or a lot of them are really good, and they are fully, fully capable of getting stories on their own. So you're kind of in against everyone. And what I've tried to do, I should mention this, over the last, I don't know, year or two, was write some longer, more featurey type stories that have news value, because you can't chase those, right? If I have something that's a story about, I don't know, a player, for instance, Chad Bettis of the Rockies, just wrote about him last week, coming off testicular cancer. I had him alone, spoke to him, spoke to his wife. You can't chase that story. That's not like, hey, we just confirmed it. No, no, no. It's different. It's a better story. It's a more human story. Sometimes those stories are more human. Sometimes they're different from that. But I have made a conscious effort to try to get stuff that people can't just confirm in 2 minutes and say, bingo, I got it too. Yeah. I'm trying. It's not easy. And I still have to, in my view, be involved in the day-to-day, because that's what people want who follow me. But there's definitely been a conscious attempt to push it forward in that way.
Ken, in terms of the role that agents play in baseball reporting, one, how would you define your role? I'm sorry, how would you define your relationships with agents? And then two, without obviously IDing any of your sources, how important are agents in terms of the news of baseball?
Well, they're important, but I don't know if they're any more important than general managers and executives and others involved in the game. Players are the most important, I would say. And I try to maintain relationships with every agent, as well as every club and every MLB person, every person in the union that is necessary to be in contact with. And I know people will say, you're getting manipulated by an agent, or you're getting manipulated by MLB. It's always something, right? I mean, I work for MLB Network, owned by baseball. I work for Fox, partner with baseball. So if you want to accuse me of being conflicted, you can certainly make that accusation, and I cannot fight that. It's fact. At the same time, I think people who have followed me over the years understand that I'm going to write what I want to write, and I'm going to report what I think is important to report, and I'm not going to be in anybody's pocket. So it's a fine line I walk. There's no doubt about that. And the people I cover, they will accuse me of things from time to time when they don't like what I'm writing, but I really try to keep in mind it's about the reader or the viewer, and if you stay true to that, in my opinion, Richard, then you're never going to lose. You're never going to be wrong. There are some times, obviously, where you're going to be walking a fine line, and I know that, and I do it, and sometimes I cross it, I'm sure. But I really, truly believe in reporting, the importance of reporting, the sanctity of reporting, and I do my best to uphold that.
Ken, how many organizations would you say would you characterize as being media friendly? And then what would you say the characteristics are of those franchises in relation to the media?
I don't know that any of them are unfriendly. Certainly some are more difficult to deal with than others. And in some cases, it's not because they're unfriendly. It's because the people working for them might not be as equipped to handle things as other teams. But I don't necessarily encounter hostility. Now, the Yankees are a big operation. They got more coverage than any other team, so it's more difficult to get in there, right? It's more difficult to get one-on-one time. There are other teams like that as well, the more popular teams. But in my role, because I'm Fox, we're doing the game of the week, I generally, when I have a request, it's honored, and I don't have that problem. Now, there are some beat writers, I'm sure, that are frustrated with their particular teams, but I don't know that any team is considered hostile, outright hostile. There are some that are bordering on that, but I don't know that we have that kind of situation in baseball.
Do you want to publicly name the toughest team you deal with, or you prefer not to do that?
I prefer not to, because these things are layered. And this particular team or this other particular team, there might be reasons why they're difficult, such as the owner being a pain in the butt to the media relations department, the GM being a pain in the butt to the media relations department, and that person dictating what the media relations department does or doesn't do. And that's not on the PR people, if you ask me. That's on the team. So I just prefer to keep it to myself. They know who they are, Richard.
That's funny. One of the things that in talking to people who were in quote-unquote print or digital and then went to television is, and we'll, I want to get into sort of the mechanics of television for you and how you learned it, but one of the things that is essentially universal is that all those reporters say the second they got on television, it changed their relationship, particularly with players, and players gave them more respect because they saw them on TV. You know, as someone who grew up in sort of the print world, you wish it was sort of the reverse, that players would give the print people maybe more props because they're, generally speaking, grinding harder. But that's not the case. In your case, has that been the case in that when you started appearing on Fox, maybe your access and or relationships with players improved, got better?
No question. And I remember the first time you ever interviewed me, I told you a story about, I think it was Albert Pujols, who said something to me while I was interviewing him in a television setting. Said something like, "Hey, you know how the media is." And I'm thinking, "Yeah, I'm the media." But they don't. The players don't necessarily see it that way. Now, the respect comes from hopefully a couple of things. One, obviously, it comes from who you are, you have that position. In my case, I do grind, and they know how hard I grind. And I'm known for that, actually, among players and front offices. It's not a secret, and I'm not alone in this. John Heyman, Buster Olney, all these guys, they are hardworking people. So I think the respect is instant from the TV, but gained as well and enhanced, perhaps, from the fact that these guys know how hard I work and how hard I'm trying every day, period.
Ken, one of the things that always stood out to me was something Scott Van Pelt said. And he said it, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something to the effect of, like, once you don't let television own you, you can start to own television. And his point was that once you sort of don't overthink the fact that you're on TV and get past whatever nerves or get past whatever your perception of how people view you on TV, then it's over, and then you could just be you. That's my long preamble to ask you, where do you feel you stand on the comforts of being on television? Because for most of your career prior to Fox, you were a print guy. This was not, you didn't choose to go into broadcast when you were 22. It sort of happened for you. So I'm interested just in the process of you getting comfortable in that medium.
It took a long time. And even today, there are instances where I'm comfortable now, but I'm not naturally a television person. We all know that. Now, I've done it a long time, so I've become more comfortable. But I went through some ups and downs at Fox in particular where they had some questions about whether to continue with me. And it worked out, and they kept me, and everything worked out fine. But it wasn't a smooth process for me at all. They sent me to a coach for a while, and the coach did some really good things with me. He slowed me down, which was very important because I was 900 beats per minute. But he almost slowed me down to the point where I was too mechanical, and that's where the problems came in. Hmm. And Fox said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm following your coach." And they said, "No more coach. Go be yourself." And they saw at the time when I was on MLB Network, I was more myself because there's more time on MLB Network. It's not 20 seconds, Joe coming to me, I got to be quick and really succinct in what I say. So it did take a long time for me to get to the point where I was comfortable. And it wasn't easy and it wasn't natural. And it also wasn't natural just the attention that comes with being on television. Print guy, you're basically thinking, just do your job and your work will shine. In television, it's different. And that's how the bow tie started, frankly. David Hill said, "I want to make you stand out. You're going to wear a bow tie." And I thought, well, wait, isn't what I'm reporting or what I'm saying and the role I'm playing, isn't that making you stand out? Isn't that enough? And it wasn't in his eyes. And he can make the argument either way, but he won, I think, because the bow tie, for better or worse, as much as it might bother me a little bit that that's why people recognize me, or that's how people recognize me. It did achieve that. So this whole world is fine to me, and I don't know that I'll ever lose that. I'm a print guy in my head. It's not even close. But I do work on television. I work a lot on television, and I would hope over the years I've gotten more comfortable to the point where I don't think about it. I don't think about it now. I just go. But it took a long, long time to get there.
And when did the charity component come into the bow tie? When did those two things intersect?
This is a good story, too. So 2010 NLCS. We're in Philadelphia. The Giants beat the Phillies, and I'm going back to the hotel to write, which is what I always do after a game, playoff game. And someone from Fox came up to me and said, "Hey, you ready to wear the bow tie?" I said, "What?" I had no idea what they were talking about. Well, long story short, David Hill wanted me in the bow tie, as I just said, wanted me in the bow tie for the World Series. And when I wore it the first game, I thought, okay, maybe that's it. And then the second game, I'll never forget this, I saw Eric Shanks by the trucks, and I said, "You want me to do this again?" And he said something like, "You know, Ken, it would probably be a good idea," because David Hill wanted this. So that offseason, I thought I was done with it, and I got a call, actually an email, from Dahani Jones, former NFL player. He's a media person now, very dynamic personality. I didn't know who he was, but he explained to me that he had this nonprofit called the Bowtie Cause, and they partnered with different organizations to represent different charities. And I thought to myself after he explained it, you know what? Fox is going to make me do this again. So I might as well get ahead of it. Might as well make something good out of it. And that's how it started, the charitable component of it. And I've been doing it now since 11. So this is the seventh season.
Wow. That's 7 years. That's, I remember, when, I think when you first started, doesn't feel like 7 years. When you mentioned...
to my wife, it does.
When you mentioned that... sort of like there were things about television that were just sort of naturally uncomfortable. Can you, especially because there's a lot of younger people who listen to this podcast who want to get into TV or just starting in TV, what did you find specifically that was uncomfortable? Was it the mechanics in terms of how long to talk, where to look? Was it the coordination with talking to your producer with an earpiece in your ear? What were some of the things that you sort of had to overcome, at least in terms of the mechanics?
I would say I didn't have a problem with the producer in my ear. I never had an issue with that. It was probably the distillation of information that maybe I would write 1,000 words about into 25 seconds or less. And that takes time before you really can do it at a proper pace where you're not trying to talk a mile a minute to get everything in. That doesn't work. You have to tell your story and tell it in a brief amount of time. And it was more that. It was more just my delivery that was the issue. And it's understandable if you think about it. Nobody trained me until this coach. I went on cold. I started doing some TV work when I was with the Sporting News, and they partnered with Fox. And I would do some different things for different Fox regions. And then I went and did ESPN when it was Cold Pizza, not First Take, the predecessor.
Right.
And I would go on there quite a bit. But, again, no one's telling me what to do. So I'm just winging it. I had no clue. So all of that is what took time, just trying to figure out how to do it best. And people would tell me when I was on ESPN, family members would say, "Hey, you talk way too fast." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? I have to get all this information, and there's no other choice." But they were right.
Ken, how would you define the differences between working for Fox and working for the MLB Network?
My roles are much different. Fox, it's a game role for the most part, and it's dugout reporter, field reporter. So I'm doing pregame interview, maybe, reports during the game, a postgame interview. MLB Network, they have a variety of shows, and I appear on virtually all of them. So it's a much different deal entirely. Now, Fox has the Whip Around show, and I'm occasionally on that. That's similar to MLB Tonight on MLB Network. But it's really the difference between game and being out in the field and being in studio, where I do most of my MLB Network work. There are times when I will fill in on a game for MLB Network, but it's not very frequent.
Do you find that there is a, a culture or a, maybe not atmosphere is the right word, but is there an archetype that when you're on Fox Sports, they want their broadcasters to be a certain way versus when you're on MLB Network, they want their broadcasters to be a certain way? Or do you find that that's not the case and they're, you know, people could swing between the two networks and you would never know the difference?
I would say the latter. And if you look at it, John Smoltz is on both, Matt Vasgersian's on both, Harold Reynolds, Tom Verducci, when they were doing the booth, Tom, of course, still does the field reporting. They're on both. So I know there's that perception of Fox attitude, and Fox has promoted that over the years. But no one's ever told me, hey, man, have Fox attitude out there. They've always just encouraged me to be me and do what I do. So I don't notice a difference in the approach between the networks. There is none, honestly.
Hmm. All right, let's go back a little bit in your career, Ken, to when you were at the Baltimore Sun. Am I right about my chronology? First, you were a beat reporter, and then you moved up to either a baseball columnist or a general columnist?
Right. I was a beat reporter. I covered the Orioles for 4 years, 1987 through 90. And then thanks to the National and Frank DeFord, I got an offer from that paper, and I became a columnist. And a lot of us owe Frank and everyone else with the National still a huge thanks. So that bears saying. But yes, then I became a columnist in 90. I was very young. I was 28. And I was with the Evening Sun, and then the Evening Sun eventually folded, and I went over to the Morning Sun. And I was a columnist from 90 to 2000, a general sports columnist, did Olympics, did Super Bowls, did everything. And the main focus was Orioles and later the Ravens after Baltimore stole them. But for the most part, I was just what you would imagine any general sports columnist to be.
All right, well, let's go back to the DeFord thing. So did DeFord make you an offer to be a baseball reporter? And then obviously you countered back to the Sun. What was he offering at the National at the time?
Well, first of all, DeFord wasn't coming down to my level.
Right, right.
I was a beat guy. And it's very funny. I was just telling my children this story. They're in their 20s. And they had no idea, and they had no reason to have any idea about this. This happened before they were born. But during that period when the National was forming, if I recall correctly, they went for the big people first, understandably, then kind of went step by step. Maybe the columnist first, the great feature writer second, and then eventually they got to the beat guys. Well, I remember, and I think I was pretty common in this feeling, just sitting by the phone waiting for them to call, hoping they would call. Because when they called, presuming you got the offer, which most people were getting, you were a made man or a made woman. Because what happened was they were offering more money than your newspaper was, usually a lot more money. And you could then, if you chose, either go or you can go back to your newspaper and say, hey, I'd like to stay, but, and that's what I did because I had just gotten married at the time and I didn't really want to be on the beat. My offer was to cover, I think, the Mets. It was the Mets or the Yankees, the beat person for the Mets or the Yankees. And I didn't really, my wife didn't really want to go to New York at the time. We live here now, and it just didn't work as well. So I leveraged it into a columnist, but I distinctly remember waiting by the phone, and this was before cell phones. So you waited by the answering machine at home, waiting for that call, and eventually they did call, and I got a column out of it.
How big a moment before I even get to the Cal Ripken passing Lou Gehrig, in reading up about you, Ken, it was interesting to me that your relationship with Cal Ripken at times had some rocky stretches. Is that a fair comparison? He's the most famous guy in Baltimore, easily the most famous athlete you were covering, but yet it wasn't always sunshine and applesauce with you guys, correct?
That's very fair. Yeah, that's very fair to say. And I saw my role as a columnist to provoke thought and write opinions and do what a columnist does. And Mike Litwin, who was my predecessor and one of the great columnists at that time, I remember he told me early on, listen, if you're not going to state your opinion, if you're just going to go write pretty things all the time, then you're not a columnist. And it's always stayed with me. So I wouldn't look for fights, but I would look for issues, and I would look to discuss issues. And with Cal, there were different things over the years, whether he wanted to move to third base. The team wanted him to at one point, and he didn't want to go. And then, of course, the streak was another issue entirely. I never actually wrote that he should end the streak before he broke the record, but I did write that afterwards. And there were times, various times, where we were in conflict. And you had to remember, back then, you're right, he was the number one guy in Baltimore, really maybe the number one guy in some respects in sports. And I remember Brady Anderson telling me this one day, Brady might deny it, but it's true. How can you criticize Cal? I said, Brady, the president gets criticized, the Pope gets criticized, every person in every walk of life gets criticized, but this guy cannot be criticized? He's above it all? And that was kind of the perception of him in Baltimore, which was a town that is not Philadelphia in terms of media aggressiveness. It's much more parochial. Not that Philadelphia isn't parochial, it is, but in Philadelphia, which is where I worked before Baltimore, in South Jersey, the standard was you have to hit a guy in the mouth as a writer. You had to rip. And in Baltimore, they didn't want that. And the fans, most of them did not like that. So there were some uncomfortable moments, no question. And I would imagine Cal to this day probably doesn't care for me. I don't see him probably at all anymore. I haven't seen him in years. But in my mind, Richard, I was just doing my job. And I thought it was important to do my job in the way I did. Now, as a younger columnist, and this was especially true in covering Peter Angelos as well as Cal, I was not so great at coming off the gas and writing a more subtle criticism or a more subtle piece that would explore things. I often threw a 95-mile-an-hour fastball too often. And some of that, yeah, I regret, but it's, in my view, part of the learning process, and I'm better now for having learned all that. So it was an interesting time, to say the least, but I love being at that paper. I never imagined leaving that paper, honestly.
Was it how uncomfortable could it get for you, I don't know, with fans or whomever, criticizing Cal Ripken, who really was, in Baltimore, something bigger than just an athlete? It's kind of an institution.
It got uncomfortable. I would say it was more uncomfortable with the owner because Peter Angelos in Baltimore, he's a different kind of big than Cal.
Right.
But he kind of runs the town. So you walk into a restaurant, hey, how can you be critical of Mr. Angelos? He's a great guy, which to many people he was. But it could get uncomfortable. And you would be abused by this, whenever I would write something mildly critical, and by the way, what I was writing by New York, Philadelphia standards, Boston standards, I would say it was mild compared to that. But in Baltimore, it was what it was.
Right.
Frequently, not always, but frequently, would go on the rights holder that night and dispel everything without ever mentioning my name because why stoop to such a level? So, yeah, it was uncomfortable at times. It was. And the most uncomfortable thing, even today, I experienced this recently, when you've written something critical or something that's going to make someone uncomfortable and you have to face that person, it's the pit of your stomach, it's not great. But in my view, it's part of the job.
How did, after you left Baltimore, how did your criticism of Peter Angelos impact your relationships covering the Orioles when you were a national reporter?
Well, actually, it kind of made me as a national reporter because the Orioles ran so many people out of there during the late 90s, early 2000s, that when I first applied to the Sporting News, and John Rawlings was the editor, great guy. And he said, well, how are you going to do this? You've been in Baltimore all these years. How are you going to be a national reporter? And I said, well, here's a list of people that I know just from the Orioles who are now sprinkled throughout baseball. And there must have been 10 or 15 names on a variety of teams. And that was a starting point. So I guess I should thank Mr. Angelos for being so hard on his employees back then. I'm saying this facetiously, Baltimore, take it easy. But that was actually part of the appeal, in my view, of going national. I had built-in sources. And then, of course, you have to get many, many more, but I had a starting point.
Did, other than it being obviously one of the historic nights in baseball, what did being what did covering Cal passing Lou Gehrig in 1995, especially for the paper of record at the time, what did that mean, you think, for your career, if it meant something beyond that night?
I don't know that it meant anything for my career, but I say this all the time. And as privileged as I've been to cover World Series for Fox, All-Star Games, Olympics for the Sun, Super Bowl, all these amazing things that I've gotten a chance to cover, that night is the highlight of my career, and there's nothing else even close. And I say that because you got to remember, this is 1995. We don't have the internet.
Right.
So everybody was coming to town, and when I say everybody, all these writers from different newspapers around the country. And they generally, not generally, they didn't read you. There was no way for people to read you unless they were in your town and buying the newspaper. So I felt a lot of pressure. And I was still, at that time, 32, about to be 33. Still pretty young. I felt a lot of pressure to do my job well. And it was a little bit overwhelming because we all knew this was coming. This was not something that just broke out. This was an event we knew was going to happen. And I remember going to the Sun before that game that night, stopping in maybe to pick up a notebook or something. And Mike Litwin, I mentioned him again, he just kind of, he was a feature columnist at that time. And he just gave me some advice. He said, just understand what this means to the city, to the country, and the whole big picture. Don't get bogged down in he's going 2 for 4 on this big night. This is a big deal. So that really guided me. And then, of course, what happened, he breaks the record. He takes the victory lap, and it wrote itself. And I basically wrote about the victory lap. And was it as poetic as many writers would have done it? Absolutely not. I'm not at that level. But for me, it was pretty good. And then I remember going home that night. I always tell this story because I love this story. And my wife had been watching. She's not a baseball fan, really. She'll watch playoffs and stuff, but she's not that into it. And she said, man, all the crap you have to cover all the time, I was really happy that you got to cover this because this was an amazing event. And that stayed with me. And if you remember, Richard, it wasn't just the president there. The vice president was also there. Joe DiMaggio was there. There were all these luminaries. And Cal's dad, who was the first manager I covered, was in the stands. And I can still see his face. He was the toughest man any of us ever knew. And he was biting his lip back to fight off tears. And it was just that kind of night. So it will always be the highlight. I can't even imagine anything surpassing it. And that includes Game 7 last year. That night was, it was beautiful. It was sports at its absolute best.
Ken, as someone who's worked in the business for quite some time and knows, obviously, the national reporters and national broadcasters, what did you make of ESPN laying off baseball-specific people like Jason Stark, Doug Glanville, and, you know, I can name a host of other baseball people. But that that really, I mean, Jason Stark in particular really struck me as sort of saying something, that if a Jason Stark isn't employed at a top place, I mean, what does that say about baseball reporting in 2017?
Well, Jason's a friend of mine, and obviously we've been competitors, so we're not close as we might otherwise be. But that day, I was on Twitter just seeing the different writers from ESPN kind of announce that they had been laid off. And when Jason did, I just had an audible gasp and a loud one. I was crushed. And I can't imagine, even now, ESPN without Jason. Jason is a unique voice in our sport. He does this job differently than anybody else. He's so entertaining, so knowledgeable, so clever. And again, he crushed me. And one reason he crushed me, I've always looked at ESPN as the best. They're the standard we all shoot for from a news perspective and really from every perspective. And at that moment, I felt they were no different than any other company. And that was quite dispiriting. And I didn't, to this day, I don't understand it. But listen, I work at a place that changes its identity a lot too, Fox. And we've laid people off. I'm not going to deny it. We're no different. But when they did it, it was just something really disturbing, to me.
Yeah, same here, as we've talked about a lot on this podcast. I want to, before I get to some listener questions, when I put out that you were going to be the guest, I wanted to ask you this. There's an interesting debate, and you've obviously written columns on this, that's sort of going on in the baseball marketplace as to, I mean, the sabermetric world exists today, and it's not going anywhere, and people, those who are into sabermetrics are really into it, and it's now on traditional coverage, whether it's Fox or regional networks. You're seeing writing, you know, analytics experts who write. Where do you see, Ken, the line? Do you see baseball in the way Roger Angel, Tom Verducci, et cetera, has written baseball over the years? Do you think that remains heading forward? Or as we head forward, does baseball become far more of a statistical-oriented game when it comes to media, specifically when it comes to the writing of it?
Well, all of us, Tom included, and Tom does this as well as anyone, have incorporated the advanced numbers in our writing and reporting. And to ignore it is to ignore the way teams are run now. Every team has this arm. Now, some emphasize it more than others, but all use sabermetrics, and all mostly in a quite prominent way. So if you're going to sit there and say, I'm not into this stuff, well, guess what? You've lost. You've passed. You've had the sport pass you by. So we do have to incorporate it. And it's fun stuff. A lot of it's quite educational, and it gives you a different insight on the sport. There are things we can verify now that we weren't able to verify before. At the same time, you can get carried away. And we have this debate. Actually, we had it just last weekend at Fox. Some of the guys on the were talking about, okay, how far do you go with this stuff? And that's an ongoing debate because not all fans embrace it. And it also can be rather dry in a television way. And I'm not talking about MLB Now on MLB Network with Brian Kenny, which is a show devoted to this. I'm talking about a game broadcast. There's a certain line that exists. I'm not sure where it is all the time, but I don't know that you want to cross it. So there is an ongoing challenge. And one of the things that bothers me about the state of baseball writing right now is that it's too easy to lean back on the numbers and use that as your reporting rather than doing what I consider more traditional reporting, working the clubhouse, talking to players, doing that kind of thing. The numbers for some have become almost above that. Now, for certain organizations like Fangraphs, well, that's what they do. I don't expect Dave Cameron from Fangraphs to be working the clubhouse. That's not his job. He is one of the best at distilling this stuff and delivering it. I'm talking about beat people who, in my view, some can fall back on it too much and use it almost as a crutch when there are other things that they should be looking at as well.
All right, a couple more here from listeners. A couple are baseball-related, and then some are media-related. I had one that asked you, Ken, how you balance being fair and impartial when using agents as a source in your column. I mean, that gets back to the larger question of how do you protect yourself from being used by people who have, whose goals are different than yours?
That's correct. And sometimes those goals might align if there's information that's out there. Not even necessarily a breaking story, but maybe an agent tells me something about a player that I think is interesting. Well, that's okay. That's useful. But you can get to the point where you are beholden to the agent or too eager, I guess, to do whatever the agent says. And that's something that you do have to guard against. And it's difficult. But, again, it goes back to what I was talking about before. I try as hard as I can. I'm not perfect, but I try really hard to serve the reader and the viewer and not the agent and not the team and not Major League Baseball and not the Major League Baseball Players Association. There are times where I tick each one of those groups of people off, and that's going to happen. But again, if you be true to yourself and true to the craft, or that's what you want to call it, you usually stay out of trouble. Now, I'm sure some fans could point to a specific instance and say, oh, look what you did here. Okay, nobody's perfect. But I would say, again, most people who read me don't see me that way. I would hope that anyway.
Ken, how do you feel about writers making their Hall of Fame ballots public?
I'm good with it. And there are a couple of schools of thought here. Some believe that that should not happen because it doesn't give you the right to make difficult decisions that maybe you don't want to reveal something about a player that you know. Say, for instance, that you know a player you covered used steroids. You don't want to vote for him because of that, and you don't want people to know that because that's not fair. That's not the way you would want that information to come out. Those folks, and I respect them, have a hard time with the public nature of making the Hall of Fame ballot public. Now, the other side of it, and this is where I fall, is that we ask people to be transparent all the time. And if we're going to have this responsibility, in my view, it is only fair and proper to be transparent as well and to have to explain and defend your ballot. And many of us do this every year, and it's going to be all public now, at least the identities of the ballots. And in my view, it's healthy, quite healthy.
And a question, why do baseball writers get the reputation of being old, smarmy curmudgeons? Do you think that's a outdated reputation, or is there some truth behind that?
I would hope that I'm not viewed as an old...
Not you. I think that's more of a larger, Ken Rosenthal thing.
I would hope we're not viewed that way. But I understand it. And I think it comes from the Hall of Fame, frankly. And this idea that we're protecting the game from these evil steroid users when we don't vote for them. And that's a fair criticism that fans might have. And my view on this is, Richard, that I respect all points of view. If you don't vote for guys because they are confirmed or acknowledged users, I have no problem with that. I took that position for a long time myself. And if you vote for them, I understand your logic. But it is a polarizing issue. And fans who look at this and see the writers who are withholding votes in their minds, that can create that perception. And, wow, these bunch of old school people are just not adapting to the times, even though what you consider adapting to the times might be much different than the next person. So I get it, and this is a more traditional sport than any other. There are more records that are known to people. So this idea of protecting the game and looking at it that way, that would probably create that. No one looks at Peter King that way, for instance. I don't think anyone looks at Adrian or Janowski that way. Baseball is different because of this history and because of the perceived protection of the sport that goes on by some.
Ken, I think if you talk to Yankee beat reporters and those around that team, I think they all would have predicted Alex Rodriguez would have been an excellent broadcaster. So if you the people in the clubhouse who are with these guys every day have a real sense of that. Now, you're not in a singular clubhouse every day, but you do travel the country and you do talk to a lot of baseball players. Off the top of your head, who would immediately come to mind if I ask you which current players do you think could make the same kind of transition that Alex did?
Max Scherzer jumps immediately to mind. That would be one. Bryce Harper could do it. He's got a few years left to play, but right. He's got that same passion and knowledge that Alex Rodriguez does. Actually, I could probably rattle off maybe 15 because the players today, they come up familiar with the media and quite comfortable being interviewed and talking to reporters. They do it from the time they're in high school, sometimes even younger than that. So it's much less of a challenge than it was when I broke into the business simply to talk to the players. But those two come to mind. I am sure there are many others as well. As I think about it now, even a guy like Carlos Correa, he's young, but he's got that A-Rod baseball rat thing going.
Right.
And those guys see the game in a different way than everyone else does. And that's why they're so special. So I could probably give you two or three from every team, would be my guess.
Yeah, a lot of people seemed, when you asked that question, at least within the sport, to mention Chris Archer of the Tampa Bay.
Archer's great. Yeah. And I know by answering the question the way I did, I know I'm leaving out certain people. Chris Archer, no doubt about it, would be very good at this. But he's not alone. Marcus Stroman, the Blue Jays, he's another guy. And there are many, many players who could, in my view, excel at it.
Do you think there's, Ken, still an interest in today's player, given the salaries are so astronomical? That always seems to be, although in basketball it's not really the case, but you sometimes hear that, like, if a guy makes so much money, he doesn't necessarily want to have a second career as a broadcaster. But then again, you know, whether it's Paul Pierce or Barkley or Shaq, I mean, these guys have made millions and millions of dollars. There are those guys who they just want to be around the game, and this is a way for them to be around the game.
Well, that's one thing I've learned, especially being in MLB Network. That all.
By the way, Ken, don't get arrested. I hear the sirens in the background. I hope everything's
it's
okay.
Just, Richard, it's just typical New York every day around here.
Right.
All the former players who work at MLB Network, I think, to a man, would say that they enjoy still being part of it. Now, they're not competing the way they once did, but they're part of it. They're breaking down different things each night. They're talking about the game. They're talking to people in the game. They're active participants in the sport, and in some ways they're competitive because I guess they compete for awards, Emmy awards and things like that. So you can even make that case, although I don't know that any of them look at it that way. But it's really healthy because even if you've made all the money, like Alex Rodriguez has made, he loves the game. So he doesn't want to just be removed from the game. And, of course, he has different concerns, too. He wants to rehabilitate his image and all that. But he has a passion for the sport, and you mentioned this. The Yankee writers all knew this. We all knew this. He could distill things unlike anybody else. Now, for years and years and years, we were all writing about everything else with him, and that was his own doing. But when you talk to him strictly about baseball, man, it's like a light bulb coming on for you as the person talking to him. So, yeah. I don't know that money enters into it for a lot of these guys. Pedro Martinez is a very wealthy man.
He's
on MLB Network because he loves to talk about baseball and TBS.
All right, final two, Ken. One will be a actual. We'll get you out of here on a current baseball question. I look right now, and again, we're only 60 games in, but the Houston Astros, I mean, look like one of the great teams of all time. As we tape this, they're 42-17. They lead their division by 13 games. It would seem inconceivable that they're not going to win the West. Their run differential, as we talk right now, is plus 104. And their home and road record is just extraordinary. When you look at this Astro team, I understand anyone can lose in the playoffs, but this really looks like, Ken, a legitimate team both this year and next year in terms of being a heavy favorite to win.
And beyond. Now, I would say right now they give the appearance of a great regular season team. They are. I don't know if they're a great postseason team yet because they've essentially got two starting pitchers who are really good, Keuchel and McCullers.
Right.
Beyond that, it's questionable. Now, I expect that they're going to trade for another one, someone who could start game three of a postseason series. And maybe even two, for all I know. But that's where they are a little bit vulnerable from a postseason perspective, setting aside, as you mentioned, the randomness of the postseason, the luck that's involved, all the crazy things that can happen. But they've been building toward this. And remember Sports Illustrated? It was several years ago when Ben wrote that story.
That's right.
And the cover said 2017 World Series champs. And they were and are maybe the leading sabermetric team. So the people who follow sabermetrics, Brian Kenny, et cetera, they have a vested interest in this team doing well. And those people refuse to acknowledge that this team has kind of veered a little bit and done some things with regard to chemistry and bringing in leadership. But they have been building through this. They tanked, if you want to use that term, got some high draft picks, and here they are now.
Yeah, by the way, my colleague Ben Ryder, who wrote that cover story, the guy's probably going to go to some tailor and get a suit made out of that cover because he is looking very good right now.
pretty rare when something like that happens.
I know.
They got to make it, of course.
They got to make it. But this, he could be. He could.
They're pretty good.
He could be in a good place. All right, and then finally, Ken. I know you. You watch other sports as well, and we're taped this. We're in the midst of the NBA finals. And understanding that salary caps are different in the NBA versus Major League Baseball, et cetera, how do you feel about the idea of a baseball team doing what the Warriors did in terms of creating a super team? You know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's next year that there's an incredible free agent class where there's just game changers all around. So hypothetically, I know Bryce Harper is like one of the guys who is at the top of that free agency list. So hypothetically, if like five of those guys sign with the Yankees or the Red Sox, et cetera, what would that mean for Major League Baseball? How would you view that in the way Durant joined Curry and Thompson and Iguodala and Draymond Green to create this super team?
Well, I don't actually follow other sports the way you would think, to my regret, because I'm so wrapped up in
baseball. I hope you've heard of the guys I mentioned, Ken, at least, if nothing else.
No, I've heard of them. In fact, I watched game two, and what a delight just to watch it, because when you don't see very often what's going on, and you just tune in to see the brilliance of all these different players, it's breathtaking. Now, I did read the Lee Jenkins story in Sports Illustrated about the way the Warriors were built and how the NBA collective bargaining situation kind of led to that.
Right.
It was a fascinating story. I had no idea about any of this. And I don't know that in baseball there's a mechanism that exists quite like it existed there. But in theory, if the Yankees want to sign Harper, Machado, and Clayton Kershaw, all the members of that class, they can do it. They can pay the money. But because of the luxury tax that exists, not a salary cap,
right,
but a luxury tax that you cannot cross a certain threshold before you get penalized, they'd have to pay literally tens of millions in penalties. Now, one of the debates in baseball is whether the new thresholds, which were not elevated very high above where they were previously in the opinion of many, including me, will stifle spending. I don't know that they'll stifle them, stifle spending, but at the same time, I don't know that you're going to see a team like the Yankees do three of these guys. They may do two. But to the greater question, is it healthy for a sport to have a super team? I actually think it is.
Same here.
To have that target. And I know parity is important, too. And it's important, and baseball fought this for years, to have fans in every city believing they've got a chance. Even if it's only for 1 year, even if you know as a low-revenue team you're going to have to tear down, that's really important. But the big bad Yankees, the big bad Red Sox, Dodgers, Cubs, whoever the team might be, the sport, in my view, benefits from that because it creates this love-hate, and it just makes it that much bigger, in my view.
I agree with you. I mean, historically, television ratings will always show you that super teams or polarizing teams always draw the highest viewership. There's a reason why this Cavs Warrior season is there, and I think it would be fascinating to see a baseball super team. At the same time, as you mentioned, the luxury tax sort of game changes that, and it's also a sport where you could build from the draft. And so, you know, probably won't see that as much.
I'm sorry, Richard.
No, go ahead.
Super teams. There was the Tigers 1 year. I'm trying to remember this. I don't know exactly the season. I'm not great at recalling which specific year, but there was a year I was trying to convince John Morosi to come to Fox, and the Tigers had assembled a super team. And John was in Detroit, and he said, I really want to cover this team. He's from Michigan. He's got the whole Michigan thing going. I just want to do one more year of doing this. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And the Tigers were terrible that year. They didn't win. So there are, I guess, fewer guarantees in baseball because you're not going to have superstars at every position. And
right,
one person cannot dominate the way LeBron can or Curry or Durant. So it's a different sport, but getting back again to the central question, it's not, in my view, bad when the Yankees are this arch villain.
Right. I would say if I'm looking at the top of my head, the 98 Yankees, Posada, Jeter, O'Neill, Tino, El Duque, Andy Pettit, David Cone, Mariano at the back end. That's not the Warriors, but that's on the same subway stop, I would think, right?
Yeah, I would agree.
So that's pretty close.
And it's different because when you have Durant, Curry, and some of the others, that's a 12-man roster.
Right, that's right.
So it's a different deal entirely. But and I know the NBA is going through this question now, is this healthy to have the Cavs and Warriors three straight years, et cetera? I don't know the answer to that because I don't cover basketball, but it's pretty compelling television right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you had Scherzer and Kershaw on the same staff, maybe that's sort of the equivalent if you have Durant and Curry, maybe. We'll see if that happens. All right, Ken Rosenthal is a senior writer for FoxSports.com. He's a field reporter, an insider for MLB on Fox, and also an insider for the MLB Network, and overcame at 22 a Newsday editor telling him he would never amount to anything and he should go to law school. I'm sexing the story up for the podcast, Ken. Ken, I appreciate you taking the time to do this podcast. I admire the work that you've done and your professionalism and continued success. Thank you for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks very much, Richard. Appreciate it.
This is Sports Illustrated's Media Podcast with Richard Deitch.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports and MLB Network. One of the best at what he does, and I certainly appreciate his time. Previous podcasts, if you want to check them out, our last one was a tribute to Frank DeFord, where we had six writers from Tim Layden to Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post who offered their thoughts on DeFord's legacy, their favorite pieces. Wright Thompson was part of that podcast. So if you haven't heard that, check that out. I think if you're sort of a sports media nerd, you'll enjoy that. Before that, James Duthie, the fine host of TSN's hockey coverage, Kevin Merida, the editor-in-chief of The Undefeated, Bob Lee, and Jeremy Schapp of Outside the Lines. My thanks to producer Lou Pellegrino. Thank you to the folks at Digital Media. Thank you to my bosses who support this fine podcast at Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.